Let's please to Genesis and another chapter. Genesis chapter 9. We need to conclude the 9th chapter, go into the 10th chapter. But before we can go into this 10th chapter of Genesis, we need to study further Noah's prophecy with regard to Canaan, to Shem, and to Japheth, and some of the far-reaching implications of this prophecy. I think I should probably start back at verse 22 to remind you of the setting. Sometime after the family has embarked from the ark, Noah has lived long enough to have a grandson by the name of Canaan, son of Ham. Noah has set about to plant a vineyard. He's a farmer, among other things, and he has a vineyard, and he's made wine. He drank the wine. He's drunk. He's in his tent, inebriated, and uncovered. A question we might ask with regard to this condition, in verse 21, it says he was uncovered in his tent. It is true that the word that is used and translated uncovered is used in other places, particularly in Leviticus 18, to describe conditions of various sexual offenses, including homosexuality. Some have therefore conjectured that this is a reference to homosexuality. There is that outside possibility, though I am inclined to think that it is not, in that it was a breach of moral propriety of actually looking upon with disrespect his father in a state of sinful drunkenness, nakedness, making light of it. I suggested about three or four dimensions to this sin, which I think, to me personally, adequately explain the gravity of this. And then as a result of this, Shem and Japheth respond to their father's drunkenness. They respond to it in a very dignified way, in contrast to Ham, and I showed you how that in the wording of verse 22, Ham was not just coming in and discovering his father naked and drunk, laid out in a very pitiful way. He disrespects the authority of his father. Ultimately, it's a challenge to the authority of God. He saw the nakedness of his father, told his two brethren outside. Those two verbs in the Hebrew indicate that there was looking upon with some kind of satisfaction, delight in the sin rather than being repulsed by it. And then he tells his brothers with some kind of delight in telling them. And Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both of their shoulders, went backward, covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were turned backward. They sewn up their father's nakedness. So they handled it in the opposite manner in which Ham handled the situation. Consequence of this is that Noah awoke from his wine, and he knew, and he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be Jehovah, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." Now, I'd like to come back and take this. I've already gone through the wording of it. But I'd like to take the whole thing and put it back together and to show you the implications of this. I want to divide it into three parts. So you may entitle this section, Noah's Prophecy, and divide it up into three parts with a conclusion. One, Canaan. Two, Shem. Three, Japheth. We'll see the implications for each. First of all, you'll notice that he pronounces a curse on Canaan. This is the third curse that we see recorded in the book of Genesis. The first curse pronounced was on the serpent, Genesis 3:14. The second curse is one pronounced upon Cain, and this is the third. And this one is described in terms of being a servant of servants, which is a Hebraism, or it is a way idiomatic in Hebrew of describing a condition of being the lowest of slaves. So there are two implications of this, actually three implications of this curse on Canaan. One is that Canaan's descendants are placed under a cursing. That's the first statement. Canaan's descendants are placed under a cursing. Ham's disregard for his father's authority, his disrespect and delight in the sin of his father, this tendency toward immorality in Ham is going to be seen as a tendency in his descendants through Canaan. The curse is not on Ham, it is on Canaan. And the way Canaan, or Ham, disregarded moral propriety, moral standards, is going to be reflected in Canaan's descendants in their disregard for moral standards. The Canaanites, who will be the descendants of Canaan, his name, of course, given to the land of Canaan, the Canaanites are going to come under demonic control to such an extent that they are going to be in widespread immorality of the grossest sort. And if you don't believe it, turn with me to Leviticus in the 18th chapter to show you exactly what comes out or from the descendants of Canaan. The Canaanites are going to come under demonic control. This will be by their own volition. Don't forget that. There is no violation of will in this matter. Leviticus in the 18th chapter, also chapter 20, you have a description of the sins of the Canaanites. He says, among other things, let's pick it up at verse 12, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister, she is your father's blood relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, she is your mother's blood relative. Incest is forbidden. They are to defile themselves not with animals. Bestiality is forbidden. Homosexuality, all of these things are listed. Down to verse 24, do not defile yourselves by any of these things, for by all these the nations which I am casting out before you have become defiled. He's describing in the context the Canaanites. And everything from bestiality, homosexuality, incest, child sacrifice, sacred prostitution, occultism, the worshiping of demons, all of this is involved in Canaanite worship. And the Canaanites are the descendants of Canaan. So the curse is on Canaan in terms of his descendants living to the ultimate experience of immorality and becoming actually mad dogs, morally speaking. They were infectious in their own immorality, and this is why God demands that the Israelites, it is God's war on the Canaanites, this is why God demands that they be destroyed, that they be removed from the land. There are a couple of things you need to keep in mind about the Canaanites. We'll study them later on in more detail. Some people want to throw out the destruction of the Canaanites as some great ethical problem in the Old Testament. I remember speaking with a young man a few years ago on this, and supposedly this was a great bone in his throat, that he had a very difficult time understanding the Old Testament. The God of the Old Testament, who could command Israel to go in and destroy man, woman, and child among the Canaanites. Should this be, or is this an ethical problem? It would be if your presuppositions are all out of order. If you go at it with the wrong assumptions, you will come to some wrong conclusions. You must, number one, remember the character of God and his demands on mankind. Two, you must remember man's responsibility before God and his obligation to conform to the moral standards of God. Three, you must remember that immorality is infectious, and God demands that the law of degeneracy become fulfilled, or rather that as a result of the law of degeneracy, he will wipe out and eliminate a nation. He will not allow that nation to contaminate other nations. God knew that Israel could not live in a unilateral situation with the Canaanites, side by side with them, and not be contaminated by their immorality. The problem that those who question the destruction of the Canaanites have problems in other areas as well, in my experience in speaking with them. They often are liberals. This questioning of God's purposes in ordering the destruction of the Canaanites flows out of liberal theology and its misunderstanding of the character of God and God's moral demands, and it seems to flow right on through into other areas of liberal thinking and liberal politics. Liberals have a penchant for being sentimental about murderers. They have a penchant for being sentimental about those who are convicted murderers, for communists, for tyrants. What is it that makes a liberal tick? That's an interesting study. I think, frankly, it's just that they live on emotion. And liberals can beat the drums over wiping out some over a war with people who are killing millions of lives, and they say we should get out and this war should be stopped and we should disarm, but they hardly raise a voice when it comes up to matters like abortion. Can you get a great crowd? Well, there was a great crowd out over this matter of abortion, many thousands in Washington some months ago. But the liberals have a way of orchestrating the press. It's phenomenal the way liberals can orchestrate the Fifth Estate. And we've all been witnesses to this when everybody met to protest nuclear energy. And, of course, they've expanded this to nuclear weapons. And they want us to do away with this. And if we'll just disarm and do away with our nuclear weapons, everything bad will go away and we'll live happily ever after. The naivety of liberals just is incredible. And also the naivety of the press moves in and just listens. And it's almost as if the liberal darlings come in and orchestrate their statements, and the press picks it up and gives them all of this publicity. And I find it that it's a commentary on the evil policies that have a way of being passed down in our culture, in our day, through the press, politically, all the way down the line. And it's simply a representation of liberalism sentimentality. And they will get up in arms over a convicted murderer. But where will they be when the victim's family has to scratch out some kind of living and try to respond from a despicable murder? They want to do away with capital punishment. Liberals live on emotion. That is why they're dangerous. They're totally subjective in their outlook, and I cannot understand how any Christian, we have some senators, some congressmen, who identify themselves as political liberals. To me, that is a contradiction in terms, but nevertheless, they try to do it. But that is liberalism, and liberalism has a problem with this matter of the Canaanites, liberal theologians. But it is no problem when you understand that the Canaanites were like mad dogs. What do you do with a mad dog? Do you pet it? Do you take it in and coddle it? A mad dog has to be eliminated. And that is what the Canaanites were. They were mad dogs. I couldn't even begin to go. I could in another place, another time. Some of the awful things that the Canaanites indulged in and how absolutely infectious, in more ways than one, their lifestyle was. And God knew perfectly well what he was doing. He gave them many years of opportunity to respond to his grace. So these are the descendants of Canaan, the Canaanites. You need to remember that when Moses wrote this, one of the purposes of recording this curse on Canaan, as well as the Table of Nations in chapter 10, is to remind Israel, and Moses probably wrote it sometime around the time of the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings, he wrote this for the purpose of presenting before the Israelites the objective in dealing with the Canaanites. He shows the roots behind Canaanite behavior. He shows the purposes of God in dealing with the Canaanites and takes it all the way back to the source. He shows that God has a purpose for Israel that's rooted in the past, and God has a plan. And Israel has a strategic place in that plan, and this is why he wants them to deal with the Canaanites in such a manner. So that is the first fact about Canaan we ought to note. His descendants are placed under a cursing. We'll see some more of this when we come to the way the Japhethites are going to deal with the descendants of Canaan in just a moment in Carthage and the city of Tyre. The second thing we should note about Canaan is that Canaan was to be a servant of Shem. Canaan was to be a servant of Shem. Now this is fulfilled historically. It was fulfilled, Joshua 9:21-27, through the partial extermination of Canaanites under Joshua. When General Joshua led the Israelites into Israel, the crossing of the Jordan, the defeat of Jericho, and then by the central campaign, then the southern campaign, then the northern campaign, under the leadership of Joshua, Israel partially exterminated the Canaanites in that campaign. It's recorded for you in the book of Joshua. That is a partial fulfillment of this curse where it says that he should be the servant. Now, there was one tribe among the Canaanites that played it real smooth, and they conned Israel. Israel fell into it. It was their fault. That's the Gibeonites. You remember that great Oscar award-winning thing they pulled off on the Jews. They came in, made like they didn't really live in the land, fooled the Jews, and ended up living with them side by side under a treaty that Israel couldn't break. But with that exception, there was an extermination of many Canaanites under the leadership of Joshua. And then there was a final subjection obtained by Solomon. You should probably look at 1 Kings 9. That'll help us here. 1 Kings 9, under Solomon, years later, hundreds of years later, there was a final subjection of the Canaanites by Solomon in his own era, in his reign, in the theocracy. That's 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 20, 21. It says, "For all the people who were left of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who were not of the sons of Israel," these are all Canaanites, descendants of Canaan, "their descendants who were left after them in the land, whom the sons of Israel were unable to destroy utterly, from them Solomon levied forced laborers even to this day." But Solomon did not make slaves of the sons of Israel. Slaves. You see that phrase? He did not make slaves of the sons of Israel. But they were men of war, his servants, his princes, his captains, his chariot commanders, and his horsemen. The whole point is that Solomon carried out this prophecy in his own day, or fulfilled it with regard to Shem. Solomon, of course, is the descendant of Shem through Abraham, and then finally, of course, the Davidic line. So there is the curse of Canaan with regard to Shem, and with the ultimate destruction of the Canaanites at the hand of the Israelites. Now, that's not all. Something was said about Shem himself. So, secondly, Shem. We're going to come back to Canaan in a minute when we get to Japheth. Shem. It is said of Shem that blessed be Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of Shem. What he's going to do with Shem is related. It has a special relationship to the name of God. So we need to identify the name of God is used here. Looks like this in the Hebrew, Yahweh. This is the name for God which identifies him as a covenant-keeping God, Israel's covenant God. Shem is going to have a special relationship to the Lord. She is going to carry about his name. The Jew will be the fulfillment of this through Shem. The Jews will carry the name of God in their, as their covenant-keeping God. So when he says that the God of Shem, or blessed be the God of Shem, he is saying that Shem will have a special relationship with Yahweh and will carry that about. Now, there is something with regard to Japheth and Shem that I'll point out in a moment, how that we become recipients of that blessing on Shem. So there is a special relationship promised between the descendants of Shem and God, specifically in the Jew. For Abraham, we'll see, was a descendant of Shem as God established the nation. So ultimately then, this promise of a blessing on Shem, blessed be the God of Shem, that this is realized in the nation of Israel, and your being here tonight is a part of that prophecy, in that you and I are recipients of the blessing of the Scriptures. This is the Bible. The Bible that we meet about, that we're studying tonight, is the result of whose hands? Well, true, ultimately, the Holy Spirit, but Jewish writers, with the exception of Dr. Luke, two books in the New Testament. This comes to us from the descendants of Shem. So we, as we'll see later, when it says, let him dwell, the Japhethites dwelling in the tents of Shem, you and I are right at this moment dwelling in the tent of Shem. You're dwelling there because we're able to study the Scriptures, because the Lord Jesus Christ was a Jew, descendant through Shem, according to the line of David, and because Jesus Christ, his Messiahship, because of the Scriptures. All of this underscores the fact that the Jew, will be custodians of Yahweh. They're going to be special custodians and communicators of the truth. To them were given what, Romans says? The divine oracles. So that is the fulfillment of the promise to Shem. And there's also a Pan in Asia here with these names. I failed to mention that with Canaan, but let me pick it up with Shem and show you. Here is the name Shem. Comes out S-H-E-M, of course. That's the way it looks in Hebrew. Shem. Now there's a play on words. So Shem, or the name Shem means name. Let's say it this way. Name is going to have a name. Who is the name? Name is going to carry the name of Yahweh in a very special sense. Now let me take you back to the name Canaan. There's something there in that word too. Canaan, let's put the noun form as it appears. This is Canaan's name. Looks like that in the Hebrew. So it comes out like K-E-N-A-A-N, Canaan. And his name is from a root verb that looks like this. That's K-A-N-A-N, Canaan. And Canaan means to be humbled, to be humbled. So the humbled one will be humbled. The name will carry a name. And we're not through yet. There's something with Japheth in his name as well. So we come to a second feature of Shem. Well, let's go to Japheth, and I can pick back up on that blessing with regard to Shem and Japheth in a minute. So let's go to Japheth and how he fits into this. It says, God enlarge Japheth. Now, isn't it interesting? I think so. That he says Elohim now. Whereas he said, blessed be Yahweh, the Elohim of Shem. Then he says, Elohim, enlarge Japheth. Well, we'll go ahead and finish out this statement about his name and the play on words. Then we can pick up the details of the prophecy. Japheth, his name looks like this in the Hebrew. That comes out Y, we make it a J, is bringing it over, E-P-H-E-T-H. This word comes from a verb which means enlargement. So, something like this. Enlargement shall be enlarged. Name shall carry a name. Humbled shall be humbled. So there is a very delicate, but again a very forceful presentation of the truths through the play on names in each case. Now let's come to Japheth. In what sense is Japheth going to be experience enlargement? Well, I need to give you three statements about Japheth. I think that'll pretty well cover him. One, the prophecy of God enlarging Japheth is a prophecy of Japheth's coming, the descendants of Japheth, in expansion and influence. Japheth is promised an extension of political influence. He will have both prosperity and power. Whereas the descendants of Shem are going to be especially noted for their being custodians of Yahweh, Japheth will be identified by prosperity and power, his descendants. Secondly, spiritual blessing will come to Japheth through Shem. Or we may say it this way, salvation is of the Jews. Now, most of us tonight are descendants of Japheth. We probably have some strands of maybe a little of each in us, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But probably most, being of Celtic or Celtic, which pronunciation you prefer, most of us are descendants of Japheth through the Celtic tribes, and I'll trace you through, take that, I'll give you some roots here in a minute. When we look at the table of nations, this will help you in your genealogies. So we see that we are promised blessing through Shem. We see this demonstrated, for instance, in Acts 10 and Acts 16. Peter, in Acts 10, going to Cornelius. Who was Cornelius? He was a descendant of Japheth. And Acts 16, Paul, the man of Macedonia, saying, come over and help us. There are two good New Testament demonstrations of spiritual blessing through Shem. Let him dwell, verse 27, the word dwell, to settle down, to abide, in the tents of Shem. That means participate in the spiritual blessings that will belong to Shem. Salvation is of the Jew. So there are, of course, there is an extent, a larger way in which the descendants of Japheth become recipients of this blessing, not only because of salvation, but what we might say is common grace. The influence of the Bible, the influence of doctrine, and its influence on Western civilization as a restraining power to sin, as being the basis for the freedoms we enjoy in this nation. That is an extension of the tents of Shem. And Japheth will be eternally thankful, and we should be thankful, though right now we're living on the fragrance of an empty vase in our own nation. We're living as a result of what past principles have brought us, or adherence to past principles. But we're, of course, we're working a day and night to try to destroy these as quickly as we can in the name of humanism. But we are experiencing freedoms today in this United States, freedoms and prosperity because of the tents, dwelling in the tents of Shem. Thirdly, Canaan is going to be the servant of Japheth. End of verse 27. Let Canaan be his servant. Now, how does Japheth fit into, or what is the relationship of Canaan to Japheth? In two ways. I'll give you two dates, and therefore two events. Write these dates down. 332 B.C. and 146 B.C. First of all, 332 B.C. This map will help us. The descendants of Canaan, where did they go? Well, primarily right up and down this land which Canaan gave his name, the land of Canaan. Living on the seashore to the north as well as to the south, a city was established by a Canaanite tribe. We know this tribe as the Phoenicians. The city of Tyre. The Phoenicians became international traders. They became merchants of, quite prosperous and successful. In their success in selling and trading and their ability in making ships, the sail of the high seas, their excellent seamanship, they developed colonies around the Mediterranean. One of these colonies was placed on the north tip of Africa in what is now Tunisia, a city called Carthage, located, it's further back to the west. I don't have it. Can't get it on this map. Here's the boot of Italy, and down at the boot, the tip of the toe, is Sicily. Then right across the waters away, we have Carthage, or the ruins of ancient Carthage. We have two settlements of Canaanites in terms of the Phoenicians at Tyre and at Carthage. raised him up in the place called Macedonia, the son of Philip of Macedon. He raised an army of Macedonians and Greeks, and he moved eastward. He moved across the Hellespont, he moved into what is Turkey, and through a series of victories, he pushed the Persians back further to the east. In his march to the east, Alexander the Great then moved south, south to the city of Tyre. The city of Tyre had to be dealt with because it harbored in its port shipping, Persian shipping, which was a threat to Alexander's lifeline, his lines of communication, his shipping. They had to be dealt with. But the city of Tyre did not give up easy. See, the city of Tyre was located strategically offshore. It was on an island. How was he going to get to it? Well, Alexander decided that he would dig in, and there were more ways to skin a cat than one. So what he did, the year 332, he began, if you can't bring them to you to battle, you go to them and build a bridge. So he had his troops begin to build a causeway out to the city of Tyre. They would take these rocks and roll them into the water and build a causeway. Of course, they had to protect themselves in the process. They used these giant, what would look to us like scaffolding with animal skins over it to protect them from the arrows the Tyrians would be shooting, and using their marksmen and snipers to try to pick the Macedonians off as they were moving closer and closer to the city of Tyre. They even sent fog men in at night, the Tyrians did, go underwater and to cut the cables, to do anything they could to stop this gradual but sure approach of Alexander's army. Well, to make a long story short, after a period of time, Alexander finally finished the causeway. They breached the walls, they destroyed the city of Tyre, and in 332 they slaughtered 8,000 Tyrians and sold 30,000 into slavery. What did he say? Let Canaan be his servant. This is exactly what the Japhethite, Alexander the Great, did. Well, we're not through with the Japhethites and the Canaanites. But there was another colony way to the west called Carthage. God was going to bring another encounter between the Japhethites and the Canaanites in the three Punic Wars, the 2nd and 1st century B.C. We would be primarily interested in the 3rd Punic War, because that was the final one. That was the deadly blow. You're probably most familiar with the 2nd Punic War, namely the invasion of Italy by Hannibal. You remember the story of Hannibal. Here was a Canaanite, a Phoenician. He took some 40 to 50,000 troops that landed in what is now, what was Iberia or Spain. And he took this army with a number of elephants, not quite as many as Hollywood would have you to believe, but they took along some elephants. The elephants turned out to be more of a problem than a help, because when they got spooked, you were in trouble. And they could do you a lot of damage, as well as the enemy. So here was Hannibal that moved up the Second Punic War. He came, well, I can get another map maybe, and to help you. Well, that's not necessary. They moved up, finally across the Alps, and that was some feat to take this army across the Alps, lost many men, starvation, disease, frozen to death. He took these men and elephants, cavalrymen, and along the way he enlisted some of your ancestors, the Celts, and he took them down through the Alps, down into the plains of Italy, and engaged in a series of successful campaigns against the Romans. He was never able fully to cash in on those victories, but the Romans never forgot it. Was it Cicero, Latin students, or Cicero, after every speech in the Roman Forum, he would end it with a statement, Carthage must be destroyed. So it came down to the Third Punic War. This takes us to the year 149 B.C. One general, Scipio Africanus, or Aemilianus, a Roman general, was selected by the Roman Senate to bring a Roman army to Carthage to demand its surrender. Carthage had become weakened, and the Romans were ready for the kill. What the Romans did is they demanded the Carthaginians immediately submit to all of their terms of surrender. The first was, the Carthaginians thought they'd be off the hook, you will have to give us 300 of your babies, 300 small children. This was no that was no small sacrifice. The story is told of the women going even out to the seashore, to the dock, as these children were to be taken off to Rome. They even tried to stop them at the last minute, giving up their children. But word came back that after this condition had been met, the Romans demanded more. Scipio demanded that not only must they do that, they must give up all their weapons, they must surrender, they must leave their city, and it should be burned. They decided it was time to dig in their heels and fight. So what they did is to make weapons factories in their temples, and they began to manufacture hundreds of swords a day. The women sacrificed their hair to make ropes to use in slings, and they decided to stand and fight. And for 3 years, they held the Romans out. Of course, this was making the Romans more frustrated and angry by the day. Starvation took place, but they held on. Finally, in 146, Carthage surrendered. They breached the walls. In the process, some very interesting stories have come to us about what happened. The Carthaginian general finally decided he'd had enough and got down with his wife and children, was on his knees surrendering to Scipio and wanted to surrender. And his wife was so disgusted that he had become a coward that she immediately ran away, took the two children that she had in her arms, their two children, and she leaped off a six-story building. He was a coward. And they destroyed the city. It burned, I think the record goes, for like 17 days. And then finally they completely destroyed it, and they took the city and they plowed the area which the city had been built. They plowed it and sowed salt all into the soil so as to guarantee no further productiveness from the soil. So at that time, 100,000 died in a three-year siege from 149 to 146 at the hands of Scipio Aemilianus, a Japhethite. So God completed this curse upon the Canaanites as they became servants of servants to the Japhethites. Now, what's the summary of all this? Let me make some summary and give some application to all of the cursing and the blessing here on Canaan, Shem, Japheth. What are some of the implications of this? One, the curse on Canaan has nothing to do with salvation. This curse on Canaan has absolutely nothing to do with salvation. I'll give you one good example. Rahab, Canaanite. This did not violate their opportunity to respond to the grace of God and become believers. Two, the curse on Canaan is not a justification for prejudice against the descendants of Ham. Ham had four sons, as we'll see in the 10th chapter. He had four sons. Canaan was only one of them. The curse on Canaan is not a justification for prejudice against the descendants of Ham. Who are the descendants of Ham? I'll have to anticipate myself a little bit here, because in the 10th chapter we'll see that the sons of Ham migrated south, and somewhat east, but into what we know as Africa. This curse on Canaan was not a curse on Ham, though Ham is not mentioned in the blessing. Canaan is mentioned in the cursing, and in no way can this curse on Canaan be taken as a license for prejudice or as a proof text for slavery. You know, that was done in the slavery days in the South. Those who were the pro-slavery advocates used this, among other passages, as the basis for justifying slavery in the South. And taking the slaves, being the descendants of Ham, were to have been, according to their interpretation, the servants of Japheth. But of course, the inconsistency there is that only Canaan is mentioned in the curse, not the other three sons. Three, the significance. What is the significance of a lack of blessing on Ham? Probably this. Probably religious degeneracy. We have not been provided with any great cradle of Christianity among the descendants of Ham. We have not been provided with any cradle or birthplace for a great movement in Christianity. With Shem, what comes from Shem? Japhethites dwell in the tents of Shem. The Japhethites have experienced the blessings and the freedoms. We think of Western civilization and the blessings that have come through the Reformation in the cradle of the descendants of Japheth. Now, I know I'm overlapping. We have to understand that there was some overlapping between the descendants of Japheth, Ham, and Shem. There is no such thing as a pure-blooded descendant of Japheth or Shem or Ham today anywhere. But there are some general movements. So the significance of a lack of blessing on Ham could possibly be the fact that the descendants of Ham became particularly susceptible to religious degeneracy. But this in no way is a basis for minimizing their opportunities of salvation, nor is it a license or justification for prejudice. Four, the Bible does not sanction slavery. The Bible does not sanction slavery. And as far as that is concerned, it does not sanction segregation either, at least the kind of segregation that was that we had forced upon us in the past in the South, the Jim Crow laws, separate restrooms, separate water fountains. Some of you are not old enough to remember that, others of us are. Scripture does not provide any justification for that act, either slavery or that kind of segregation. Five, racial groups, though I must be quick to say that when we talk about Japheth, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, we're not primarily talking about races so much as we are cultural or geographical and linguistic groups, which I'll show you later on. We're talking about cultural or linguistic or geographical groups of people. When we think of race, we think of skin color. But that, when we come to the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, is not a lot of help, because we find some of the descendants of Japheth being darker than some of the descendants of Ham. So hold your horses in case you picked up some very poor information about that. You think all descendants of Ham are black and all descendants of Japheth are white. That is not true. Besides that, there has been a crossover even in Scipio Aemilianus, the general who destroyed the Carthaginians in 146. He had some Hamitic characteristics or background in his own family tree. So he was not, say, purely Japhetic. So the racial groups, five, racial groups may be superior or inferior at any point in time, but not biologically. That's important to remember. Racial groups may be superior or inferior at any point in time, but not biologically. That is, they're not superior or inferior because of some genetical structure. It's because of other things, namely the influence and effect of doctrine on their own culture to the extent they've accepted those influences or responded positively to doctrine. You need to remember that, and that is something that you do not hear very often today because of the tendency to immediately say that something like that is racism. But there is a word that's been absolutely ruined of any significance because it's used so promiscuously. So races can be inferior and superior at any point in time in history, but not because of genetics, but because of cultural strengths and weaknesses. For example, we have on the island of Crete the establishment of many churches, and Paul put Titus on, gave him that responsibility. And at that point in time, the Cretans were terribly degenerate. They were almost ready to fall into the law of degeneracy, which the Canaanites did. And the Cretans were a tough lot to control. And God put, Paul sent Titus in there, and he had to get the churches organized. People were saved. But you had all these cultural weaknesses that came in. They were fighters and brawlers and just had a hair trigger tempers. And so you may find cultural weaknesses, which is learned behavior from one generation to the next. So certain cultures or racial groups can be strong or weak at any point in history. And you're not a racist when you acknowledge that, recognize it, and realize what the remedy is. But I think that's probably enough on this, though we'll see some implications of it when we come to the 10th chapter in the Table of Nations. I might add this final point, that no matter where the cursing lies at any place in the plan of God, that cursing can be turned to blessing by evangelism. By the grace of God in salvation, any cursing can be turned to blessing. But let me stress again, this curse on Canaan has nothing whatsoever to do with our current racial problems in this nation. Nothing. Now, we could talk a while about the racial problems and segregation and integration, and we probably should somewhere along the line in our studies. But in no way whatsoever can the curse on Canaan be justification for any kind of Jim Crow laws, separate restrooms, separate eating facilities, riding in the back of the bus, and that kind of thing, which, of course, unfortunately, many of our parents and grandparents lived with, accepted, and in some cases actually encouraged them. Frankly, this ought to shame us, and there ought not to be any boasting about it. I don't know anything to be proud about in that part of the past. And I am not in any way, regretful or ashamed of my Southern heritage. But I see that part of the South as being a very embarrassing and a very, not just unfortunate, but most regrettable era in our history when we allowed this and justified it. There was never any reason for it. I could have lost my hide for saying that 25 years ago, probably in this area in the South. And it probably still wouldn't be safe in some places. If I said that in some churches, I'd probably have to be packing my bags tomorrow. But I wouldn't mind, frankly. And that's why we have always tried to keep the decks absolutely clear with regard to race in this church. Never at any time is anyone barred from this church and membership, any activity, because of their different color of skin, a different national origin. We've even put it in our Constitution that no one will ever be kept out of this school or this church. And if we ever have a school, that no one will ever be barred because they are yellow or black or whatever national origin. Now, if you personally have some problems with this matter of race, you need to probably think through it in a very careful manner. It is possible for you to understand the weaknesses and strengths and the problems of cultures clashing, the weaknesses in one culture clashing with the strengths of another culture. I'm not saying that you have to sort of be Pollyanna about the problems of integration. I realize there are all kinds of difficulties, and that is something not to be blind to, but I am speaking about a one-to-one basis. When you deal with people on a one-on-one issue, that you should demonstrate the love of the Lord in all cases. And if you deal with any person at any time by looking at them simply as a part of a group, you're acting just like a liberal, because that's the way the liberals are. They can't think of individuals. They can only think of groups. And they've grouped us to death. You've got every class against every class, middle class, lower middle class, upper class, lower class, this ethnic group, that group. They always wanted to compartmentalize us and put us in some cubbyhole. And when you treat people as a class rather than as individuals, you are falling into that same kind of error. So I think that's enough to be said. We might ought to stop and take questions, since we've almost gone as far as we can go on this issue. And I know that there is so much in the 10th chapter that I'll never be able to treat it just, give it due justice. I can say a few things by way of introduction. And if there are any questions, I'll be glad to take them. What we're going to see in the 10th chapter, and it will be, we'll just use as an introduction to the Tower of Babel, because chapter 11, verses 1 through 9, precedes chapter 10, chronologically. That's important. Chapter 11, 1 through 9, precedes chapter 10, chronologically. And what we'll see in chapter 10 of Genesis is a table of the nations, their dispersal throughout the world as it existed, or as it was in the days of Abraham, leading up to Abraham and in his day. It provides us a background for understanding the implications, consequences of Babel when God confounded the languages. We're going to notice this, that God is going to zero in on, he's not so much interested in Japheth, Ham, or Canaan, as he is in whom? Shem. Because he's going to come to Shem very quickly. He's saving Shem till later in the 10th chapter. You'll see that. He deals with the descendants of Japheth, the descendants of Ham. Then he comes on down to Shem. And there is particularly one descendant of Shem that he's especially interested in. Who is that? A man by the name of Eber. Eber. E-B-E-R. Whose name is the root for Hebrew. And it will be from Eber that we'll go down even more. We'll narrow it down further to a man by the name of Peleg. And from Peleg, we'll come into chapter 11, verse 16, and eventually we'll get to people like Nahor and to Abraham. Why? Because we're bringing, being brought down narrow, narrow, and narrow to come to the line of the Messiah. And as Moses wrote this, it was to impress upon Israel God's sovereign control over history and their special place in his plan, and that he controls all the nations, where they have migrated, where they have moved, as he took the Japhethites up and west through Europe and the Celtic tribes, as he took the Shemites as they went west or east and south, as he took the Hamites and moved them south. And you can see God's sovereignty in dispersing the nations, Acts 17. All from one family, but spread out by the sovereign hand of God, but yet keeping in all of this the solidarity of one group of people. You cannot do that with any other group of people. You cannot say, well, you're all Japhethites, or you're all Hamites, or you're all Shemites. But there is one group that God has protected, the solidarity of that group. And that's Israel. Through all of this, why? So as to demonstrate his purpose and plan on this earth through that group of people, the Jew. And that is all designed in this book of Genesis to encourage Israel with God's absolute sovereignty in the movement of nations. So we'll start out next week in chapter 10 with the inspired account of the history of the nations, or the inspired account of the roots of anthropology and the dispersal or the confounding of languages. And it might even be time to talk about cavemen. Some have had a question about that here and there. And you're wondering where Neanderthal and all these, because we obviously haven't had room for them yet, have we? Where do we get cavemen, so-called? So we'll slip that in, but that's where we'll take up. Any questions on what we've covered in this prophecy in Genesis 9? Anything that not clear, we can go back over some. Satisfying to know that all the questions have been answered. All right. Let's dismiss in prayer. Father, may we ourselves be personally encouraged as we've seen your sovereign hand prophesied, demonstrated. Lord, we realize that our life is dealt with and controlled in the same manner. You have a plan laid out. You have a way in which you want us to walk. Our God, we're thankful that whatever comes into our life is a part of your overall plan, and even the cursing can be turned to blessing by your grace. In Christ's name we thank you. Amen.